Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
My name is Valerie Opapari, and I want to welcome everyone who's joining us today for the third in a series on mentoring and roles and responsibilities. And today's discussion is going to focus around the concept of a master connector, which was coined by Malcolm Gladwell, an individual who, because of their expertise, their position within a field, their knowledge, their network of individuals, that they can serve as someone to master, connect people together, and allow for really good, strong mentoring relationships. So we have three questions for our panel to get the conversation going, and I'll just open it up to our first. So in the role of a master connector, I would like to ask our panel today, how have you approached successfully matching mentors and mentees and perhaps networking for them? And secondarily, what responsibilities do you feel a connector has to that relationship ongoing?
Thank you, Valerie. I think this is really an important issue and something that can have a lot to do with dealing with the burnout that we tend to have. I mean, truly, as a master connector, you have the opportunity to talk about the values of mentorship and to make sure that people in your department, division, whatever organization that you're working with, understand that this is one of the few things in medicine that you can do that's going to have a real positive impact on both you and the mentee that's having that relationship. It's also a very much of a responsibility of the master connector to make sure that the mentors understand what they are obligated to have in the relationship, that they have to be good listeners, they have to be available, they have to set time frames that they can meet with the mentee so that the mentee feels respected and not hurried during those time frames. And they have to be able to give constructive feedback in order to be a successful mentor. And I think as a master connector, you have the opportunity to talk to people about that and make sure they understand that. You have the opportunity during review sessions, when you're doing yearly reviews, departmental reviews, to talk about mentorship and how valuable that is. And so I think there's lots of ways that as a master connector that you can help people understand the value of mentoring relationships and how to make those mentoring relationships successful.
Craig, I want to follow up on that a little bit. So let's say you're doing that as a chair or a dean, you've been in that role, and now you're out of that role. Does that master connector work stop when you're no longer in those positions of authority?
I do think that as you move out of a position in which you were formally recognized as having the role of master connector, your ability to directly influence those relationships does change. It's no longer do you have the bully pulpit in which you can, you know, stand up there and understand what people want to hear and say the things that you think are important for them to hear. On the other hand, you do have a different perspective of understanding ways that you can more informally influence those relationships. And just because you're no longer a position of authority doesn't mean that you don't have the opportunity to continue to influence those relationships informally.
As a master connector, you need to be very careful about creating the relationships because it's so crucial for them to work. And to do that well, to make those connections work, I think you need to know the people that you're connecting, especially the mentee. You need to know what that person's strengths and weaknesses are so that you can, what their areas of interest are, so that you can find the right person or people to serve as mentors. And I would say that I found that more than one mentor frequently is critical. So you may need a research mentor as well as a clinical mentor, but you need to understand the people that you're connecting. I think Craig made this point, but I would emphasize it. It's so critical for the future, both of the mentee and the mentor, to understand that they're gonna make a difference to both of their careers by how well they do the work and how careful they are about the interactions so that they do make the connection work. And then I think you mentioned this, the networking is really important. Getting people at meetings connected with other people in their field, with others who are doing the kind of research that they're doing, really helps them appreciate the breadth of their impact potential for the future. So networking for them is really critical. I'll never forget a phone call from one of my mentors to someone else who said, you know, this Strauss kid can do some stuff. And that made a huge difference to me and to my career. So I think it's really important to have the networking component as well as the matchmaking component.
This has been an interesting discussion so far. In terms of acting as a connector, I have two vignettes that I'd like to share. When I took over as chair of the department, we had a very small department with a very small research portfolio, only about 50 faculty, and only two NIH grants, one that was expiring, neither of them R01s. The one that was expiring, we were planning to put that investigator on some bridge funding. Part of what I was asked to do by the dean was to grow the department, but specifically to grow with an idea toward the academics, the teaching and research. Part of my package was the ability to bring on a vice chair for research. And together we had the idea that although we had a very small research footprint in pediatrics per se, the Health Sciences Center included schools of dentistry, pharmacy, nursing, allied health, and the main campus included education, business, engineering. So we put out a request to everybody, all of the faculty across both campuses, across all colleges, to let us know if they were doing any research related to children, pediatric care, that they would be willing to include in a database. And if so, what was their source of funding? Who were the people involved and how could we reach out to them? What was the research question? And did they take trainees? This turned out to be a huge and wonderful undertaking, far more rich than we knew of. And it turned out to be a very good connector, if you will, in that we were able to find postings for our residents who are interested in doing research. It was a great recruiting tool, and specifically to the connector point, unanticipated benefit was that we had sent this back to everybody who contributed. Some of them discovered that there were other people in other schools or other campuses doing similar work or had tools that they could use. And it led to quite a few grants being new grants with new people based on this database. The database persists to this day. The other story is more global. I've had the great privilege of being an honorary professor in Lviv in Western Ukraine and working there and getting to know the people. The trainees and the attendings there are extremely hardworking, very bright, but with limited resources. The young pediatric pulmonologist, my field, was very keen to learn bronchoscopy, but also to pick up on other things going on globally. We were able to arrange some time for her to work in London with colleagues of mine at Imperial College. I was able to speak with a number of companies and ask them if they could give me their demo bronchoscopes that were not able to be used here, but to donate them to my friend in Ukraine. We were able to have her join our virtual International Pediatric Research Academy through the American Thoracic Society. And best of all, the professor in Prague that runs the European bronchoscopy course has been a friend of mine for almost 40 years. He actually spent time in my lab many years ago and agreed to take her on and to sponsor her as well. And so it's a lot of who you know and maintaining those relationships. You never know when they're going to help out. And each time you help somebody else, it helps you as well.
Those are great comments. So our second question that we developed for today's conversation was, how does the role of a master connector change during times of plenty, when there are absolutely no issues with position availability, funding, or candidate pipeline, versus those times when there are substantial constraints in each of these areas? And Bruder, I'm going to ask you to start our conversation on this question off first.
Thank you, Valerie. Those previous comments were wonderful. I had someone reach out without my knowledge, my advisor, David Smith, the clinical geneticist at the University of Washington when I was an intern, that changed my life. I got a call from someone who I'd never met, and David had called them and said, you need to offer Bruder Stapleton a chief residency and nephrology fellowship. I said, I don't know you. He said, David Smith called me and said, I needed to hire you. And when David Smith calls, I listen. And it has inspired me. It's not the only example of people who've been kind to me over time to really be proactive in trying to connect people and to introduce people to individuals who I think can be helpful. And so I've not based that on the external environment, but more on the individuals who were involved. I do think that it's important to connect people who are realistic and who understand this situation and have experience and have demonstrated resilience. So helping to connect people who, with individuals who you've observed, work through challenges and hard times, like I consider now a hard time, I think most people would. On the other hand, I think the qualities of mentorship are not necessarily determined by the external environment, but by the individual. So as I thought through this, the question as you ask it, I'm not sure that in my mind it changes too much, but it does cause more reflection in hard times to identify individuals who can provide support and experiences that are people who are not easily daunted by the external environment. So I think it's identifying mentors and connecting them is so important. And I always try to introduce faculty to people at the national meetings and stuff who I thought might be beneficial to their career. And I think that, as Arnie mentioned, the networking is so important in terms of helping people feel comfortable. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, I'd really like to introduce you to someone, but if they've never met, it makes it harder. So those are some thoughts.
Yeah, I think you make some really great points. In particular, you know, the comment around when times are tough or resources are limited. I mean, I remember Larry Boxer, you know, at the time I was starting my research laboratory, the funding at the NIH was, I think, less than 8th percentile. And I kept saying to him, how am I ever going to get a grant? It's just never going to happen, you know, 8th percentile. And he said to me, Valerie, stop worrying about that. That's my job to worry about. Your job is to work with your mentor and just do good science. And I think that encouragement that master connector can give you to just keep your head down and keep focused and keep moving on. And I think the opposite part of it too is that master connector, when there's times of plenty and nobody seems to be worried about where the next important resource is going to come, that you put a reality check on things. Like, no, you have to produce. You need to get there. You can't, things might not always be good. So I think you raised some really, really great points with your comments. Wesley, I wondered if we could ask you your input on this question too, because you go around the country working with candidates and institutions, recruiting outstanding individuals. And, you know, obviously resources are a part of that. And I think in your role, you really do a lot of connecting and connector work between candidates and institutions. So could you give us some of your insight onto this question?
I was struck by Craig's comment about the bully pulpit. As an executive search person, you really don't have any authority. You only have influence, and you have to put the best interest of the candidate and the client if you're doing this job the right way. I do think the leaders that we work with that have been successful have had people like Bruder referenced, you know, that have advocated for them even when it wasn't requested. And I think that happens on both sides of that equation. But I think those type of influences have helped people to put together those packages, Valerie, that will allow somebody to have meaningful impact in their leadership role. We do live in a world of scarce resources. And I think those people advocating for candidate or client, if you will, is really what helps those leadership opportunities to come together. So we're honored to play a master connector role, if you will, in a very different way. Dr. Stapleton and I had an opportunity this morning to have a conversation with a candidate that has been promised things at one place and was going to walk away from opportunities at another. And as we all know, nobody controls institutional boards and deans and other things. And so playing a quiet role in helping people to stay connected and to connect in more meaningful ways. We all have those opportunities, but it's definitely a honor for us to be able to do that in that regard.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for those comments. All right. So our last question, and this is not meant to be kind of a negative downer, if you will, but in the past two decades, we've really experienced several major challenges in medicine. As examples, we had the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, when many of us were serving in leadership roles and had to have significant reductions to our budgets, actually within just a few weeks. It was such a tragic period. We had the COVID epidemic and struggled through that in pediatric medicine. And now we have funding to biomedical research that's being affected across the country with some of the changes that are occurring at the federal level. So I wanted to ask our panel today, as you reflect on these experiences, which are not going to be, you know, they may be uniquely different in the decades to come, but downturns in economy and stressors that we experience are not going to go away. We just may not be able to predict what they might be. But as you reflect on how you led during those times and how you served as either a mentor or a master connector, how did the role and responsibilities that you had in these roles change and adapt to successfully transition through these difficult times? And I'm going to ask Bruce if you might get us started on this question.
That is a fun question, because early on in the pandemic, with colleagues from both our school and from the Netherlands, we wrote a paper published in Pediatric Respiratory Reviews called COVID-19, discussing telehealth, teleresearch, and teleeducation, speaking of the adaptations that we've made, as well as things that should be sticky. This turned out to be one of my most highly cited papers. I believe it's been cited more than 400 times. And many of the things that we did during COVID turned out to be sticky, if you will, and very useful. We found ways doing education better than just a talking head. And in terms of research, we found that many of the things that we were doing face-to-face could be done better and more efficiently remotely. And so it's not only how did we adapt, but what adaptations did we use that are still useful today?
Thank you, Bruce, very much. Robert, could we have you reflect on this question about roles and responsibilities needing to adapt?
Thank you, Valerie. I'm not sure I'll be able to specifically answer your question, but preceding comments have made me think about the manner in which you connect people. There's some people who are self-starters and just a phone call to a colleague to ask if they'd be available or interested in mentoring, or a suggestion to the mentee that they contact someone is sufficient to get them started. In my own circumstance, I was reflecting as a brand new faculty member, I had some research ideas, and my mentor actually arranged an appointment with a chair of another basic science department. And he went with me to meet with this man. And it struck me in so many ways. First of all, it broke the ice. It also broke down the potential perception of a hierarchy. And it just gave me great confidence that my mentor was supporting my career. And I was shocked at how receptive this department chair was of this young, bumbling surgeon. So I think sometimes it takes a little more assertion on the part of a connector to make these valuable connections. I think Arnie referenced the fact that you really have to know both the mentee and the potential mentor. The other thought I had about the same fellow, Dave Tapper, was my mentor. When he passed away, I had the opportunity to go through all his files, and there was a massive file of correspondence where he had made all kinds of connections for other surgeons around the country, not just his own faculty and his own department, but aspiring young surgeons in different institutions. And it made me realize that David viewed his responsibility as a connector to go beyond the four walls of our hospital or our university. And I admired that greatly about him. And I think we need to do a little bit more of that. I think he must have thought every day about how he could advance others' careers.
The most valuable thing, even with rich resources, are the people. The people are what makes the connections. The people are what can provide resources. And pediatricians, I often joke when I talk to the students, have an activated promoter on their nurturing gene. And in that sense, we are all very keen to help one another out and to help out young trainees. I've had very few people say no, and it's enriched me as well as the people that I'm connecting.
Those are absolutely wonderful comments. I can't thank you enough. I think you're so right that when you are in a position of influence and opportunity and you can make it happen for others in your own institution or outside, it first of all, it's one of the greatest gifts you can have. But second, the impact that you can have on so many people in so many directions and so many mentor-mentee dyads is really truly a blessing that a master connector has. So,
yeah, I think one other point that I think is worth making, and it follows on what Bruce was saying in terms of collecting data from lots of different sources. There are many people who sort of have the mistaken impression that indeed you can only have one mentor, or if you're the mentor, that you have sole responsibility for that mentee. As a master connector, you really have the advantage not only of having the network to find out who might work out well with who, but perhaps having multiple people work with the same individual. And during time of scarce resources, that sometimes can make the difference in terms of helping someone be successful. So I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you. I want to thank the panel for this wonderful discussion on the topic of a master connector. I think this series has been fun for us to do, learning a little bit about the differences between network and mentoring and mentorship. And now today, just the significant role a master connector has in bringing teams together and supporting them through their growth. So I thank the panel and look forward to our next Pediatric Insight.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. The Child Health Advisory Council includes the following members: Bruder Stapleton, Craig Hillemeyer, Arnold Strauss, Peggy Troy, Valerie Opapari, Danielle LaRocarina, Robert Sawin, and Bruce Rubin. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.